This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
I want to begin with a true story. I don't take that lightly. For a historian of antiquity to tell something that he knows really happened is somewhat rare. I know that what I'm going to say now happened because it happened to me or by me. So I'm fairly certain that it happened. About 45 or 4 years ago, when I wrote the first course for Israel's Open University, the very first course, the name of the course was From Jerusalem to Yavne. And it dealt really with the transition in Jewish history from a centralized Jewish religious national center in Jerusalem to what happens after the year 70. And we were the first course. I had no precedent. I had nobody to copy. And I came up with this brilliant idea that we're going to call at random 25 people in the state of Israel and ask them, when do they think Galut began? To make the story even more precise, the question had to be more precise, I will ask them, in our Israeli national anthem, Hatikva, we refer to Hatikva Batshnot Alpayim, the hope of 2,000 years, which seems to suggest that 2,000 years ago there was some favorable reality that somehow was corrupted, right? When did those 2,000 years begin? Was it a particular event, or should we simply count back 2,000 years in history and see what Naftali Hirtz Imber, the author of Hatikva, meant when he said 2,000 years ago? And of course, then the question begins, do you count back 2,000 years from when he wrote the poem or when the poem became the national anthem? I actually figured out that if you went back 2,000 years from when it became the national anthem, it would take us to the civil war or the internal fighting between two Jewish factions in the post-Alexander Janaeus era, when there were these political parties opposed to one another, meaning we have really, after 2,000 years, returned to what once existed. But I was going, by the way, you should know, for those who are interested in trivia, that the 2,000 years do not appear in the original poem written by Naftali Hirtz Imber. This is only in the amended text, right? The original text has Hatikva hanoshana lihiyot am chofshi ba'artzenu ir ba David chana. There's no mention of 2,000 years, but assuming everybody knows, I called some 20 to 25 people, asking them, when did the 2,000 years begin? I was, by the way, much later on told, remember, this was in the early 70s, that poll was not scientific. It wasn't representative of the population of Israel because many people did not have phones in the early 1970s. So you were really aiming at a very particular sliver of society, right? And you weren't getting the full range of opinions. Nevertheless, what was interesting is that out of the, again, I think it was 20, I can read it here now, the vast majority said the destruction of the Second Temple. That's the turning point. Some did not know that it was the year 70, but they knew it was the destruction. That's where Israel goes into Galut, right? Two people actually said it came earlier when the Romans conquered the land of Israel. And they didn't know to say 63 BCE, but they knew that the Romans conquered Israel before the destruction. They ruled here for over 100 years before they destroyed Jerusalem. One person I was very impressed with said the defeat of Bar Kokhba. In other words, this is 65 years after the destruction of the Second Temple. That person knew that, in fact, there's still political activism in the land of Israel, and maybe even for a very short-lived time, an independent Jewish state under Bar Kokhba. He's striking coins. He has an army. He certainly conquered certain areas. And so one person knew to cite that. And then, of course, there were three people when we immediately, once we asked them a question on the phone, they answered, they haven't decided yet. And as you all know, those are the only people that politicians are interested in, right? They're the ones that you have to work on. Everybody else is already a foregone conclusion. But of course, what this confirmed what we thought as we set out to write this course, and that was that most people consider the main turning point in Jewish history and the beginning of Galut with the destruction of the Second Temple. We're going to hear in a few minutes that not all historians agree, certainly not one historian who was my teacher's teacher at the Hebrew University, Gedalia Alon, we'll see that in source number 3, who believes that Galut, by all criteria, doesn't really begin till hundreds of years later, and maybe only with the Arab conquest of the land of Israel, because there's a major Jewish center that remains in the land of Israel, and it's politically active. It even has a patriarchate, a nasi. Alon will also claim that there is the community of the land of Israel still controls Jewish life in the diaspora as well. But the question is, and this is really what interests us here this evening, what were the emotional reactions to the fact that Israel, or the land of Israel, no longer can serve as the religious center? How did the Jews of the diaspora react when they heard that Jerusalem was destroyed, that there's no longer a temple? Did it immediately affect their lives? Or did they simply say, gee, what a shame, and go on with life? And there are radically different approaches among modern historians. And I want to give you just an example here on the first page of how different people interpreted what happened. My first example is Professor Martin Goodman, who's a professor at Oxford, very serious fellow, and we're very good friends. And he has an article, Diaspora Reactions to the Destruction of the Temple. And on page 27 of that article, he says as follows: there is every reason to suppose that the razing of the temple horrified diaspora Jews as much as their Judean compatriots. Jews outside Palestine seem to have presumed the central importance of the temple in Jewish worship, despite the physical obstacles to their frequent attendance at the cult. In other words, Jews in the diaspora, he claims, realize that the essence of Jewish religious behavior is focused in Jerusalem, and even their own behavior, which may never have seen Jerusalem, nevertheless, they would send funds there, as we saw last week. They assumed that Jewish religious behavior is centered around what he calls the cult here in Jerusalem. It is a fair assumption that even those diaspora Jews within the Roman Empire who had not themselves suffered in the war of AD 66-70 were profoundly affected by its consequences. If this were the only opinion, we could accept it. Except that the second fellow, whom I quote on the first page, has a radically different approach. Marcel Simon was a Christian theologian and historian of the 20th century. He wrote a book called Verus Israel. Verus Israel is a loaded term in Latin. Real, true Israel. It is one of the terms that very often is understood to define how the church saw itself as the real Israel, or if you want, the inheritor of the old Israel, the defunct Israel. But he wrote an interesting book which set out, at least he claimed it set out, to claim that anti-Semitism is not inherent in Christianity. Yes, Christians, the church did at one time persecute Jews, but the original clashes were not so much part of Christian theology, he claimed, but rather of the fact that at a certain stage of history, these two groups, the Jewish community on the one hand and the church on the other hand, were both vying to attract the pagan outsiders, this pool of pagan people living throughout the world, to their particular beliefs. In other words, this competition caused tension between the two groups, he will claim. And he knows exactly when this begins. He says the real competition begins as a result of the destruction of the Second Temple. Why? Well, let's read what he has to say, source number two. The loss of the temple, first of all, removed the inequality between the Palestinian Jews able to keep the whole law and those outside Palestine able to keep only a part of it. In other words, the destruction is the great equalizer within Judaism. No longer the main difference between a Jew living in Jerusalem and a Jew living in Rome. But he goes on. For Jewish universalism, the temple was an obstacle and a hindrance. It was a forceful reminder of the connection between the Jewish religion and the territory of Palestine. In destroying Jerusalem, the Romans forcibly dissociated the Jewish religion from the Jewish state, for manifestly the former, meaning the Jewish religion, continued throughout the world, whereas the latter, the state, did not. In this, the Romans, in the long run, did Judaism a service. In other words, what he's going to claim is, but without a temple, without a focus on territory, rendering it much more spiritualized and non-territorial, they can now approach the outside world on an even footing with Christianity. You're a religion, we are a religion, and now the pagan world can choose which is the more attractive of the two. In other words, this universalism that now takes over because there is no focus on territory, on land, right? This actually did Judaism a service. He continues. Boucher Leclerc, who was a well-known French scholar, says very rightly, quote, far from overthrowing Judaism, the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem relieved it of the embarrassment of the cult. It is not impossible that in certain Jewish circles, these events were seen, indeed, in a more positive light. So whereas Martin Goodman said that the Jews of the diaspora were, in fact, horrified by the destruction, according to Marcel Simon, they were rather satisfied, right? Because now they could open up to the rest of the world without this barrier, right? These events were seen indeed in a more positive light and were actually greeted as signs heralding new and better days. Again, for us, this is rather uncomfortable, to say the least. Just reading this is very annoying. What is interesting is that Marcel Simon published, the book itself was published in English only when you get literally to the end of the 1940s. He had written it before the Holocaust, but it was actually published after, and he really thought this was going to be a gesture towards Judaism. In other words, now, you know, we consider you to be much more, as it were, spiritual and normal. And yes, there was tension between the two groups, but that's because we were both vying, right, to attract that same pool of people out there in the world, the pagan world. So you have two radically different approaches here. And then you have the third approach, and this is Gedalia Alon. Gedalia Alon, I could talk about him a lot for all sorts of reasons, personal as well as academic. Gedalia Alon was born in 1900, if I'm not mistaken, in Lithuania. He went to the Slabodka Yeshiva in the teens of the 20th century, where he got to know my father. That's part of the story, right? He was a brilliant he was Talmid Chacham, as it were. He then, on his way to Palestine in 1923, 24, 25, he went through Berlin, studied there, learned classics, came to Israel. In Israel, he was no longer really what we would call classic Orthodox, right? He wasn't. But he continued living within a Talmud-oriented world and mindset. He was a brilliant Talmudist, but he knew classics as well. Very similar to, you may, of course, be familiar with the name Saul Lieberman. He grew up in a very similar atmosphere as Lieberman, right? And Gedalia Alon, ultimately, he died very young in 1950, but he was a young teacher at the Hebrew University. never was granted a tenure or professorship. He was really not recognized, but his close friends knew what he was. But other people passed him in the academic, as it were, race for recognition. His book, his main book on the history of the Jews in Talmudic period, was not, he did not write it, but rather it was based on the notes of his students, right, who for a couple of years were taking down every word that he said, and then a number of people, including my late teacher, Professor Shmuel Safrai, right, had it published, and it was published originally in Hebrew, and then it came out in English translation. The English translation, the Jews in their land in the Talmudic era. Gedalia alone was convinced that 70 was not the main turning point, as opposed to what we've seen, Marcel Simon. Gedalia alone was convinced that, yes, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, but if we look at all the other criteria, and here he lists, I kind of listed them very briefly, but in volume one of The Jews in Their Land, page 10, he talks about hegemony of the homeland. The hegemony of Palestine over Jewish communities within the Roman Empire was expressed in the following ways. Religion, and then he goes on to talk about halachic questions. In other words, he's convinced that for the next few centuries, if there are halachic, legal problems that arise in the diaspora, they send them to the land of Israel to be solved. Two, law, Jewish civil law, not just religious halacha, civil law as well, emanates, beginning with the Mishnah, of course, and that would be one of his main proving points, right? Judiciary, Jewish judges in the diaspora were appointed by the patriarch. What he means here is ordination. According to Talmud, smicha in the Babylonian Talmud, minui in the Palestinian Talmud, smicha can only be given in the land of Israel. And so if you see somebody with the title rabbi, rabbi, so-and-so, that means that that person received ordination in the land of Israel. And Alon says this is proof that the center is still here in Judea. Four, communal organization. Through their legates, the patriarchs could appoint and dismiss leaders of Jewish communities abroad. And this is true. And this goes on until the end of the 4th century and into the very beginning of the 5th century. There was a process of the patriarch, the Nasi, in the land of Israel, appointing messengers, apostoloi, right, the Greek word, and they could, in fact, depose heads of the community or appoint heads of a community. And then they did something else, which we mentioned last week. They also gathered funds in the Roman Empire, throughout the Roman Empire, to be brought back to the land of Israel. Discipline. The leadership exercised religious supervision over the communities abroad, including the power to impose sanctions. Only, first of all, only ordained rabbis can penalize somebody. That is to say, if you transgressed, a penalty, a fine will be imposed. The word in Hebrew is knas, right? And knasot can only be given by ordained rabbis, and ordained rabbis can only thrive in the land of Israel. And so there's this technical power of the rabbinate in Israel and control over the diaspora. And then, number six, support taxes to the patriarch and the sages. What I've done is laid out the problem. By the way, since I spoke about Gedalia alone, right, when I was a young man, a very young man, and this is a true story again, the second true story today, my father once asked me, you know, what do you plan to do in life when you grow up? And I told him, you know, I'm really fascinated, since I was in yeshiva, that there's a history behind the Talmud. In other words, these people really lived, and there must have been some historical context. And I'm thinking of going into the history of the Talmudic world and actually making that my calling. And my father, and you have to appreciate what a litvak is, right? I remember my father saying to me, yes, that's very interesting, but you'll never be a Gedalia alone. I've lived with that all my life, and when I told my wife that story, she refused to forgive him forever. Right. But who are we to believe? And that's what we're going to do now. We're going to read sources that give you a sense of how the new reality is reflected both in the diaspora and in the land of Israel. I would begin by saying, and this is something that people are not aware of, During the Second Temple period, nowhere do we encounter complaints emanating from the land of Israel, complaining about Jews living in the diaspora. Nowhere. Which is fascinating. And you would have thought that when the Jews actually established a state under the Hasmoneans, and the state independently existed for at least 80 years, I always hasten to say, 80 years, we're kind of coming close to 80 years, right? And that was the last Jewish state until ours, right? You would have thought that with the existence of a state, people would start writing nasty letters. What are you still doing there? And yet nowhere do we hear about this. And what is fascinating is we're only going to begin, for the very first time, to read about complaints against diaspora Jews after the Bar Kokhba War, when there's absolutely no state. You would have expected just the opposite, right? Without an existence of a state, without a center, without Jerusalem, without a temple, how can you come and complain to a Jew living in the diaspora? What are you doing still there? And yet those complaints will appear only after Bar Kokhba, and we're going to have to address that. But the other issue we have to address about Jews is something I hinted at the very end of our talk last week, and now I want to give you the source and show you how different historians interpreted the source. This is number four. The author of this text, a fellow by the name of Svetonius, a Roman historian who wrote the lives of the emperors. He wrote a series of biographies about the various emperors, and the emperors that he deals with, among other things, are those that are very relevant to our history, right? Titus, first of all, Vespasian and Titus and the people that were very central in the destruction of the temple. And as I mentioned last week, maybe not sufficiently, in the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple, Vespasian imposes a Jewish tax on all Jews of the empire. Now, this is an important point. In other words, he sees Jews living in Egypt or in other parts of the empire as being no less responsible for the war that the Romans had to fight in Judea, right, that led to the destruction of Jerusalem. Because obviously, Jews could have said in Alexandria, well, what do you want from us? We weren't part of that war. There's no proof that we supported the war. We didn't send soldiers. We didn't send money. There's no evidence whatsoever of diaspora support of that war. And yet the Romans considered the Jews apparently to still be a nation, as it were, or at least some sort of ethnic community, and not simply, fellow religionists. And so Vespasian imposed a tax on all the Jews, and the money was actually being gathered. Instead of the shkalim that were sent to Jerusalem, they would now have to send money to the Temple of Jupiter in Rome, which had been destroyed just a few years earlier in the days of Nero, the great fire. So it made sense. Right. Suetonius says the following about that tax. Vespasian, you'll remember, destroys our temple. He dies in 79. He's succeeded by Titus, who really destroyed the temple. I mean, he was actually here. Vespasian was already back in Rome at the time. Titus lived as an emperor for only 2 years, from 79 to 81. And then his brother Domitian succeeds him from 81 to 96. Titus was loved by the Romans. Roman historians say those that the Romans loved died young, right? And that was Titus. He, of course, becomes deified, whereas Domitian, whom we'll read about now, was pretty much despised by many of the Romans of his day, and so he will also suffer damnatio memoriae. The Romans have a process of what we would come to know in our time as like de-Stalinization, right? Where if you really hate somebody, what you do is you simply erase his memory, right? And they would do that to someone like Domitian. But Svetonius tells us the following, and I'm quoting this from the English translation that you'll find in Menachem Stern's Greek and Latin Authors on Jews and Judaism. For those who don't know, this is the one book I have to recommend, although just simply because it's the classic. Menachem Stern was our teacher at the Hebrew University also, and he did something remarkable. He simply gathered every speck of reference anywhere in classical literature to Jews or Judaism or the land of Israel in three volumes. Menachem Stern, again, had an unbelievable memory. He was also a mensch, I mean, which in academia is kind of rare. But he was an unbelievable, and I can tell you that, you know, some geniuses, you'll ask him, does such and such term appear anywhere in classical literature? And if they're very, very into the literature, they will say, yes, I think it appears in Julius Caesar in such and such place, and it may also appear in Tacitus. Menachem Stern, you could ask a question, does this phrase appear anywhere in classical literature? And he would kind of close his eyes for a few seconds and then say, no. To be able to say no, right, to questions like that means you're talking about somebody very special. His book is a classic. This is a book that will be on the shelf and all our other books will long be forgotten. And here he quotes the story about Domitian. Besides other taxes, that on the Jews, that we just referred to, was levied with the utmost vigor. And those were prosecuted, and now comes an interesting statement, which Jews were prosecuted? Those who, without publicly acknowledging that faith, yet lived as Jews, as well as those who concealed their origin and did not pay the tribute levied upon their people. So there are two types of Jews here. There are those whose origin is Jewish, but there now are also Jews who what? Who live as Jews, but don't spread the word around. And they are not our originally Jews, right? Which means now what kind of Jews does the author recognize exist? Not only ethnic Jews, but, well, converts or people, right? Exactly. In other words, people who have embraced Judaism as a religion, right? They're not part of the ethnos. They're certainly not Judeans coming from the land of Israel, but they have embraced the Jewish religion, right? And then he tells us, Svetonius, I recall being present in my youth when the person of a man 90 years old was examined before the procurator and a very crowded court to see whether he was circumcised. In other words, Domitian was very, very cruel in exacting that tax. Look and see what Stern and Martin Goodman have to say about this source. On source, page number 2. Domitian made the levy of the tax more rigorous by exacting it both from those who were not Jews by origin, but adhered to the Jewish way of life, and from those who were Jews by birth, but tried to evade the tax by concealing their origin, like this 90-year-old man. Martin Goodman takes it a step further. The Roman state and Romans in general, for the first time, came properly to appreciate that people of non-Jewish origin could become Jews. After 96 CE, when Domitian dies, the definition of a Jew by the Roman state was, for the purpose of the tax, a religious one. For Romans, Jews were those who worshipped the divinity, whose temple had been destroyed in Jerusalem, and who refused to worship other gods. Now comes this important bottom line. I suspect. So Romans are now beginning to think about Jews who live in their midst as being part of a, quote, religio, a religion. Not an ethnic community anymore, but a religion. And now I suspect that this innovation had a profound effect on the self-perception of Jews in the diaspora. In other words, that it slowly begins to seep in from the Roman surrounding environment into Jewish minds as well. If they consider us a religion, maybe, and there are these proselytes around, these people who convert, maybe we are a religion. Once you begin to think along those lines, if that was the case, what does that do to the self-identity of diaspora? It seems to remove at least some of the stigma, right? Because now we're not talking about territory anymore. We're not talking about a focal point in Jerusalem. We're talking about people that adhere to a particular way of life. And so now the big question will be, might it not have developed that Jews living in the diaspora will slowly tend to legitimize their life there, right? And here I can tell you, not only during the Second Temple period do we find no complaints from Jews of Judea about life in the diaspora. This continues in the first two generations after the destruction as well, even in rabbinic literature. And this is what is striking. We have hundreds of statements issuing from the mouth of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, rabbis Joshua, Eliezer, and of course the greatest rabbi of all, Rabbi Akiva. Hundreds of statements. Not one statement that comes out against the diaspora existence, against the diaspora phenomena, claiming you must not live abroad. When you come to the post-Bar Kokhba, when you come to the post-Bar Kokhba period, just that which is the age, the generation right after Rabbi Akiva, you encounter, and this is startling, a shift in the attitude. And you know what our problem is? We have rabbinic statements from the land of Israel between the years 70 and 200, 220 if you want, the Mishnah, right? We have no Jewish literature from the diaspora, either the Roman diaspora or, until the 3rd century, the Babylonian diaspora. We don't know what they think. We're guessing based on what rabbis in Eretz Israel say about them, or what Romans begin to think about them, or what Marcel Simon says Christians begin to think about them. We have Christian references, right, to Judaism. We have some Roman references. We don't have any Jewish references. So, excuse me? Philo is long dead. Philo, first of all, brings no complaints about... He doesn't quote anybody writing him nasty letters. What are you doing living in Alexandria? And Philo was dead by the destruction. And we don't know then what Jews were saying or writing about the destruction. But the question is, can we work backwards and see what happens? And I'm going to suggest that we can do part of this, because we do have a lot of literature beginning with the post-Bar Kokhba era. Beginning in the middle of the 2nd century, we begin to, and I'll go to the famous ones immediately. And this is something that people tend to overlook. They quote rabbinic sources. What I would teach my students from day one is the source an early source or a late source. Is it a Tanaic source, meaning of the period of the Mishnah, first two centuries, or is it a Talmudic source, the 3rd to 5th or 6th or 7th century? Is it coming from the land of Israel? Or is it from the diaspora? Sometimes, even when the Babylonian Talmud quotes a text, it's quoting a text from Eretz Yisrael, and we have to be very careful to note that situation. And you'll see in a second what I mean. The Tosefta is a book, we can argue, is it after the Mishnah, parallel to the Mishnah? Some people claim that the sources in the Tosefta precede the Mishnah, even. There are all sorts of opinions, but it's early, right? It's what we call Tanaik, meaning the rabbis of the Mishnah period. A person should always live in the land of Israel, even in a town in which the majority of residents are Gentiles, and not abroad, even in a town in which all the residents are Israelites. Now let's ask ourselves what realities are being referred to here. Abroad in a town that is all Israelites, Pumpedita, Borough Park, what have you, right? In other words, that's what they mean, right? I'll go a step further, and we'll see this next week. The Babylonian rabbis will say as much. Babylonian rabbis will say, you can't leave Babylonia, even to move to the land of Israel. And I'll talk about that, as I say, maybe a bit later today, but certainly next week. But even the first clause here, a man should live in the land of Israel in a town which the majority of residents are Gentiles. We have to remember, one of the effects of the Bar Kokhba, of the debacle of Bar Kokhba, of the defeat of Bar Kokhba, was that cities that had once had been primarily Jewish now became mixed. And what you have is a movement of non-Jews, Gentiles or Samaritans at times, moving into cities like Caesarea, moving certainly even enhancing the population of cities like Beit She'an, but moving into Jewish cities like Lud, Lida as well, and other cities. And that would be a direct result of the Bar Kokhba war. And this law, right, this demand not to live, right, abroad, even in a city most of whose residents are Jews, seems to reflect this period, right, and again, it's in the Tosefta. This is the first time we hear about a complaint emanating from the rabbis of Eretz Israel about life in the diaspora. Ultimately, we'll see this, they are going to use phrases that I think won't be repeated until Yitzhak Rabin, right, who will call those people who moved to the diaspora nefolet shel nemushot. How do we translate that, right? The dregs of, I don't know, right? A very nasty statement. What's going to be fascinating today is we're going to see something strange. In rabbinic literature, the big complaints about living abroad or moving from Israel abroad appear in the aftermath of the state, when the state no longer exists. Whereas in our days today, or that example being Yitzhak Rabin, but there are others, the biggest complaints against living abroad were when the state was founded. In other words, now there's a state, everybody should move to Israel, right? And what are you doing living abroad? So it's just the opposite, right? Today things have changed, as you know, right? You're not allowed to say certain things. It is not politically correct to say nefolet shel nemushot. You're not allowed to quote Rabin on that line, right? But here we begin to sense something's happening. Now look at source number six. Source number six is quoted in the Babylonian Talmud, but it's a quote from Israeli sources. I'll say something about that in a second. For whoever lives in the land of Israel may be considered to have a god, but whoever lives outside the land may be regarded as one who has no god. Now, you have to understand why I like this, because we saw already last week in the Babylonian Talmud that the Babylonian Talmud has no problem saying, why did God exile Jews abroad so that there should be many converts, right? Laharbot bahem gerim. And I almost see this as the response of the Israelis saying, you know, before you bring other people to God out there in the diaspora, we want to remind you that you don't have a God, right? Right? Because, and now he continues, right? For it says in Scripture, I am the Lord your God who brought you forth from out of the land of Egypt. Latet lachem et eretz Knaan liot lachem leElohim, to give you the land of Canaan to be your God. It's a package deal. In other words, you can't have one without the other. So you can't have God without the land of Canaan, or vice versa. What is interesting is the Babylonians knew this text. They quoted it in Tractate Ketubot. But if you read in that, there's a long section that deals with Israel diaspora in the end of Babylonian Talmud Ketubot. And the Talmud does something fascinating. A colleague of mine at New York University wrote a whole article in a book that I edited, Jeff Rubenstein has a long article on this, where he shows something very interesting. For every pro-Judean statement in the Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, immediately after that, what do you have? A negation of the statement. Right after this statement, right, those who live abroad do not have a god, comes a statement by the head of the yeshiva in Pompedita, Rav Yehuda, Kol ha'ole mi Bavel Eretz Yisrael over ba'aseh. He who goes, right, to the land of Israel from Babylonia transgresses a positive scripture. Just the opposite. And he brings a proof text, and the proof text is proven to be not accurate, but so on. And Rubenstein shows very nicely that the Babylonians had to argue with this. In other words, they were aware of these complaints coming out of the land of Israel, and every one of those statements immediately finds a rejoinder. Today it's different. Now, of course, you realize what I'm suggesting here, and this is so far just a suggestion, and I don't know how far I'll go, and I won't have to take sides, because I think in the end, and this will be next week's lecture, I think this ultimately emerges as a dispute between the two centers, between Eretz Israel and Babylonia, where the sense of, has Judaism evolved into, quote, a religion, a spiritual entity, is territory, real estate. Har Tzion, right? Har Haba, has it lost its potency? Has it lost its real meaning? And we're going to see that in the Babylonian rabbinic literature, they will tell you Tzion, Zion, no longer refers to a place. It refers to a concept, a spiritual concept. Tzion, shemitzuyanim b'halacha, right? They excel in halacha. It's not land anymore. And what I suspect is that it begins here at the end of the second century. We begin to read these statements. Not only that, we know that following Bar Kokhba, there was also a movement of rabbis and of others abroad. Not a mass yirida, not a mass emigration from the land, but certainly a movement. And look at source number 7. Whoever leaves the land in a time of peace and goes abroad, it is as if he worships idols. For it is written, I will plant them in this land in faithfulness, there are typos here I see, with all my heart and all my soul. If you go abroad, you're worshiping idols. Now, in a time of peace, Bar Kokhba is not a time of peace, but people are leaving after Bar Kokhba. Beginning in the year 193, a new dynasty comes to the throne in Rome, the Severan dynasty. They will rule from 193 to 235. And everything we know about them suggests that the status of the Jewish community in the land of Israel became much more recognized, so much so that the rabbis will tell a whole series of stories about how our patriarch, Yehuda Hanasi, and the Roman emperor, a fellow by the name of Antoninus, were the best of friends. They studied together. They were a chevruta. They did philosophy together. Not only that, Antoninus, according to one source, actually converts, but of course he doesn't tell people around. By the way, they were actually born on the same day, according to one legend. But of course, Yehuda Hanasi was born during the Bar Kokhba uprising, the immediate aftermath of Bar Kokhba, when it was forbidden to circumcise. That was one of the decrees, one of the Hadrianic decrees. And so the two mothers exchanged their babies, right? In other words, Yehuda was circumcised, but then given over to the Roman woman so they would never discover him, right? And of course, the idea being that during the days of Yehuda Hanasi, we got along famously with the Romans. There is even a place in Rome called Knishta de Asveros, the synagogue of Severus. And people, by the way, there's a whole literature about who this Antoninus was. I mean, you realize if I'm pressed to say who I think it was, I have to be very careful how I say that. These could be legends, right? It could be that we're talking about the local Roman governor. Who knows? We have no information of Yehuda Hanasi going to Rome. We don't know who the Roman emperor was, who was his bosom buddy, right? In the 19th century, Jewish historians wanted it to be Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a well-known Roman emperor, and the Maskilim wanted him to be Antoninus. Why? He's the last of the Stoic philosophers. If our Rebbe, Yehuda Hanasi, has to have a Roman friend, it has to be this great philosopher. There's only a problem there. Yehuda Hanasi, according to all the sources that we have, lived 30 years later. It just doesn't work. There was a Roman emperor by the name of Caracalla, one of the Severan Romans, 211 to 217. And there's a story told about him that he once saw a person beating up a Jew, and he scolded that person for doing it. And so, we have a pro-Jewish emperor. It must be Caracalla. You see what we're basing ourselves on and how careful we have to be. But having said that, it could be that the Tosefta is referring to that. What the Tosefta does know is that certain people, leaders of the community, are jumping ship and going abroad. Jumping ship? You don't jump ship? No. Yeah. I know I grew up in an earlier generation, right? But look at source number 8. A person should not go abroad unless wheat sells at the price of 2 se'ah for a sela. Without going into the nitty-gritty of Rome, of coinage, the point being, only if wheat becomes outrageously expensive may you go, in other words, may you go abroad, right? Rabbi Shimon, now this is Shimon ben Yochai. This is a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, and he is really one of the champions of living in the land of Israel. In other words, here we're in the second half of the second century, post-Bar Kokhba, and he appears in a number of these sources. Under what circumstances, meaning may a person go abroad? Only in a case when he, meaning a person, cannot find any to buy, even at that price. But if he finds that he can buy wheat, some to buy, even if 1 se'ah sells for a sela, meaning a ridiculously high price, you may not go abroad. For thus would Rabbi Shimon teach. Elimelech, the book of Ruth, of course, right? Elimelech was one of the great men of his generation and a leader of the community. And because he went abroad, the very beginning of the book of Ruth, he died there with his sons in famine, while all of Israel survived in their land. As it is written, when they come back to Bethlehem, what does the Pasuk say? Vatehom kol ha'ir, all of the city was amazed, and they said, Hazot Naomi, is this Naomi? All of the city was stirred because of them. This teaches that all of the town, meaning Bethlehem, had survived, but he, Elimelech and his sons, died in the famine. This is aimed at somebody. Now, do they really have a problem with Elimelech, I wonder? I mean, they do, but clearly this appears within the context of all these other anti-diaspora movement statements. And one can only surmise that Rabbi Shimon sees people leaving for the diaspora, maybe even for Babylonia, we'll see that in a minute, and he can't abide by this. For him, this is the ultimate, right, sin, and what we saw before, it's as if you don't have a god, or if you're worshiping idols, and so on. Again, I suspect they might be talking about people going to Babylonia. Look at the next source. This is again Sifrei. Sifrei is the Tanaitic Midrash to the book of Deuteronomy. So again, we're talking early text. We're talking about a text that takes us to the end of the second, maybe the beginning of the third century, but no later. It happened that Rabbi Yehuda ben Batira and Rabbi Matia ben Harash and Rabbi Hanania, the nephew of Rabbi Joshua and Rabbi Yonatan, were going abroad. Now, this is an interesting text. Why? Because all of these rabbis appear in other sources abroad. And you have to wonder if the person telling this story did not simply gather these rabbis into one story. What would this be likened to? You are all familiar with the story of the 10 martyrs. Asara Harugei Malchut. But if you look at the list of the 10 martyrs, you discover very quickly that not all of them lived in the same generation. And so clearly somebody at some stage gathered these 10 martyrs into one room, into one story, right? And it could be that that's what happened here. Meaning what? That the person telling this Agadah, this Midrash, he has a problem with all of these people. He knows that Matya ben Harash went to Rome. We saw him last week, by the way. We saw Todus Ishromi. Matya goes to Rome. Judah ben Batira goes to Upper Mesopotamia, to a city called Nisibis. It's in Turkey today. Hanania, the nephew of Rabbi Joshua, goes to Bavel, and he'll do the unthinkable there. We're going to read the whole or part of the story next week. It's a wonderful story. He intercalates the calendar in Babylonia, which is a grave sin. This was something that only Israelis should do. And we'll talk about this at length next week. And so I suspect that somebody gathered these names together as, right, symptomatic. These are the people that abandoned us. They were going abroad, and they reached Platana, which is a city in Lebanon. and remembered the land of Israel. They raised their eyes heavenward and wept and rent their garments and recited the verse, "Ye shall possess it and dwell therein. Ye shall take care to do all the statutes and the ordinance." And they said, "Dwelling in the land of Israel is equivalent to all the other commandments of the Torah." And then what did they do? They continued on their merry way. So they were weeping and wailing as they crossed the border, and so much for, right? In other words, and I also suspect that the storyteller, because he's going to tell another story in a minute, he wants you to get that point. Oh, yes, they recognize you can't go abroad, but they did it anyway. In other words, they even come out worse. In other words, these are not just simple people, ignorant of the fact that one may not leave the country. They know, and they weep, and they rend, they tear their clothes. They know exactly what they're doing, and nevertheless, they do it. And then there's another story. It happened that Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua and Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar were going to Nisibis. But here you have, in other words, another two rabbis are leaving the land to Rabbi Judah ben Beterah to study Torah from him. Okay. This is the first case anywhere in rabbinic literature where somebody has to leave the land of Israel to go abroad to study Torah. You have no case before this. In other words, so, and Nisibis is the northern part of Babylonia, as it were. And so here they reach Sidon. We know where that is, right, in Lebanon. Remembered Eretz Israel, they raised their eyes, and I, of course, made this long story short, and said, "Dwelling in the land of Israel is equivalent to all the other commandments of the Torah," and they came back to Eretz Israel. In other words, the second group does come back, and I think that whoever put this midrash together is juxtaposing the two stories. In other words, some people do come back, but look at the ones that don't. Now, why am I convinced? Because in the first group, you have this fellow Hananiah ben Achi Rabbi Yoshua, Hananiah the nephew of Rabbi Joshua, and he will be taken to task. Elsewhere in the Talmud, we're going to read what a terrible thing they attribute to him and why he no longer, he's abandoned us. In fact, he may even be excommunicated. We have halachot, and we can't go into all of these, but I'm looking at the time, remembering last week, yes. but look at number 10. He, the husband, desires to come. This is a halacha. What happens if you have a couple? They live abroad in the diaspora. One of them wants to move to make aliyah, and the other doesn't. And we know, what is the custom in such a case? The custom is to fight. But of course, in the end, the decision has to be who has sway, who has the final word in between the husband and the wife. He, the husband, desires to come to Eretz Israel. She does not wish to come. She is coerced to come. But of course, what interests me is the continuation. If she wishes to come and he is coerced to come. In other words, what is the defining factor here? Not the husband or the wife, but the land of Israel. In other words, if one of the couple wants to come, that person can force the other to come. So this is already, again, in the Tosefta. So now there's also, as you can see, there are different versions here of this text, and it goes on to give other variances. But the point being in these halachot is the land now. And remember, this is a land that no longer has Jerusalem, no longer has a temple. Now we're talking already Eretz Yisrael, right? The source doesn't complain about diaspora Jews, but it says if there's a dispute between husband and wife, the land is the decisive factor. So you should come to the land. You shouldn't leave the land. And now comes one of the most difficult sources that says it all. But this is a source that tells a story that purportedly took place in the 3rd century, number 11. By the way, there's a mistake here. I had another 11 here. Forget about that. Moed Katan. PT here, Palestinian Talmud. Moed Katan. I have to, et chata'ay ani zocher ayom. I used to lecture very often at Yad Ben Tzvi, way, way back. We're talking late 60s, early 70s. And I edited a book by the late president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, and his wife, or widow at the time, Rachel Yanait, would come to my lectures. And she would say, you know, if it was in English, she would also come to English ones. And she would say, you know, I love everything you say except one thing. Why do you keep on calling it the Palestinian Talmud? You know, Palestina, the low Palestina. Right? And I had to tell her that that's what the Romans called it, right? And of course, and this is an important point for our lecture. It was precisely in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba War that the name of the land was changed from Judea, right, to Syria-Palestina. In other words, it becomes Palestine after 135. Before that, it's still Judea, and even the Romans call it Judea. You all know the Roman coins commemorating the destruction, Judaea Capta, right? But now it is Palestine. A certain priest approached Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama. Rabbi Hanina Bar Chama, he's interesting. He's an ole from Bavel, and we all know that they are the extremists, right? Right? All of you sitting here, right? Or many of you sitting here. He's the rabbi, probably in the city of Tzipori, Sepphoris. And this Kohen asks the following question. My brother has passed away, leaving a childless widow. And of course, you know what the problem is. This requires levirate marriage, yibum, or chalitza, right? Is it permissible to leave the land for Tyre? Tyre is just across the border in Lebanon. To perform a mitzvah, either of levirate marriage, yibum, or chalitza, that is to release the widow from her bond to me. And you know, think about it. A, this is a cardinal mitzvah, because you're freeing a woman from otherwise being anchored, being, you know, aguna, she can't marry, she can't do anything, she can't get on with her life, so this is a cardinal mitzvah. How long does it take to go from Israel to Tyre? We're talking a few hours, right? Although I can tell you that some of my colleagues at the Hebrew University many, many years, well, not too many years ago, used to rub it in at me and say, yes, it takes just a few hours to go from the Galil into Lebanon, but it can take years to go back from Lebanon into the Galil. And they kind of guessed where I stood and I knew where they stood. In any case, so he asked the rabbi, can I go abroad to Tyre to perform a mitzvah? Listen to what the rabbi answers. He replied, your brother left the land. Blessed is God that killed him. Do you wish to follow in his steps? You know, so much for rabbinic empathy right here. You wouldn't expect to hear a sentence like that. Some say, he replied, your brother abandoned his mother's bosom, chek imo, and embraced a foreign bosom. Blessed is God that killed him. Do you wish to follow in his steps? Now, what is fascinating? As Hanina Bar Chama makes this statement, telling us in no uncertain terms what he thinks about people abandoning Israel for the immediate diaspora, as he's saying this, Rav Yehuda in Pimpedita forbids his students to go from Babylonia to the land of Israel. Something's happening. In other words, you can't imagine two more extreme approaches here. What's creating this tension? And this is not the only case. Now comes source number 13. And this source number 13, and then source... I think the numbers here got missed up here. Sifrei Deuteronomy. Okay. This deals... Or ultimately, I'm sorry, source 12. You can't understand 13 without 12. Source 12 deals with one of the most fascinating phenomena of the Talmudic period, the appearance of a custom where Jews dying abroad have their remains sent for reinterment in the land of Israel. I can tell you the history of scholarship on this phenomena. When does it begin? It doesn't begin with Jacob telling Joseph, I want to be buried in the land. He's an Israeli Jacob. ושכבתי עם אבותיי וקברתני בקבורתם. I want to be buried in the family plot. My question is, when does the custom begin where a person who never saw the land of Israel, whose father and grandfather never saw the land of Israel, have his body, or have his children send his body for burial in the land of Israel? We have no literary information about this until we get to the Talmudic period. There's no information about this. Even when you find grave sites in Jerusalem of people from abroad, it could easily be that these were pilgrims, or even people who moved to Jerusalem and died there on pilgrimage, and they're buried there. But we don't hear any ideology of why a person would want to be buried in the land of Israel. And here I can just tell you one other story, and again it has to do with my father, right? And again, true story, when my father passed away in New York City, and I had the body sent here for burial in Sanhedria. And I'm sitting Shiva, and I start thinking. We just did a very interesting, we performed a very interesting mitzvah. What's the basis? When does it start? It appears in rabbinic literature, but how did it begin? You're sitting Shiva, you're not allowed to learn Torah. So I'm sitting there smiling at all the people visiting me in the back of my mind, right? I'm trying to think, what do I do? The day I got up from Shiva, I went to the National Library, you'll be happy. I went to the National Library, sat down, and wrote the article on the origins of the custom of sending the dead for burial. And you can literally piece together what the two reasons were that were given. There are two reasons. One of them begins in the early 3rd century, another in the second part of the 3rd century. The two reasons were, A, those who are buried in the land will have their sins atoned for. V'chiper admato amo, the land will make expiation for the people. The adama, yechaper, right? La'am. The second explanation will appear, and that is that those who are buried in the land of Israel will rise up first with the advent of the Messiah. When the Mashiach comes, they will rise up first. And then there's a whole story, of course, what about all the righteous? And the Talmud deals with this. What about the righteous who are buried abroad? Won't they rise up in the Messianic era? And the Talmud says they will have to go through a process of tunnels will be created, right? The word for tunnel in Hebrew is very interesting. And their bones will roll through these tunnels, right? And then they will come to Israel, and then they will rise up. And then they quote the book of Ezekiel that talks about the bones, right, rising up again. The word is mechila. And the word mechila in Hebrew has two meanings. It means tunnel, and it means expiation, right, for sins. So it's a gilgul mechilot, right? It is a rolling, it's expiation. It's a gilgul of mechila within these mechilot. Nobody ever mentioned this before me. I don't know why. Anyway, now comes the best story. Rabbi Bar Koraya, number 12, and Rabbi Elazar were sitting and studying Torah in the Ilasis. Ilasis means the glass factory, but there are different versions of the word here. They're sitting on the outskirts of Tiberias when they saw coffins arriving from abroad. So here we are already in the 3rd century. People are sending coffins from abroad because the custom already has become established. Said Rabbi Bar Koraya to Rabbi Elazar, regarding these I apply the verse from Jeremiah, in your lifetime, Nachlati samtem to'eva. You made my possession abhorrent. Right? In your lifetime, you had no use for the land. You made my possession abhorrent. Nachlati, the nachala, samtem to'eva. And in your death, he now quotes the other part of the pasuk, actually the first part of the pasuk. They twist the sentence here. And in your death, you came and defiled my land. You can't expect to hear a more, right, extreme. Now, what is this saying? We don't need dead bodies here, right? These people who send their bodies, they want the best of both worlds, literally. Both worlds, both countries and this world and the next world, right? And this source comes out and says, we can't abide by this. You can't have both. So here you see opposition to a custom, right? Whereupon his friend Rabbi Elazar said to him, "Not so. When they come to the land of Israel, they place upon them, upon the dead body, or in whatever, the sarcophagus or coffin or whatever, they place upon them a lump of earth, thus atoning for their sins. On what basis is this assertion made? And the land make expiation for his people. V'chiper admato amo." I have to tell you, though, this, by the way, is the source. They put a lump of earth on the coffin, and that expiates for sins. This is, of course, the source of a well-known industry of Admat Eretz Yisrael, and there was a time in the Middle Ages when anybody, and even in modern times, people coming to visit the land of Israel would take back, right, a sack, right, or some container of Admat Eretz Yisrael to put in the coffin. And I found an amazing medieval responsa in a book called Or Zarua, quoting one of the heads of the Babylonian yeshivot, Rav Shrira. Rav Shrira says, and this tshuva never got really famous, never got published. He says, "From this midrash I learn that the expiation for sins with Admat Eretz Yisrael only works in the land of Israel." It's only when the coffin is there already and you put land. Had that response to become public, a whole industry would have gone down the tubes, right? I mean, I was always reminded of the fellow who comes, you know, the Italian pilgrim who visits Israel, and then he gets back to where he's going, and he gets off the boat in Naples, and as he gets off the boat, he suddenly remembers, "Oh my gosh, I forgot." You know, he forgot to bring it with him, right? What do you do? And he probably looks around, and there's nobody watching, and he kind of, picks up, who's going to know, and it's the thought that counts, and so on, right? But here you realize the tension. This is a source where you can really feel the tension. Not only that, source number 13, and we have to go a little faster now here, source number 13 says, "V'chiper admato amo," is quoted by Rabbi Meir, not in the third. He's Rabbi Meir, second century. He's a Talmid, he's a disciple of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Meir says, "From this we learn, from that pasuk, anyone who dwells in the land has his sins expiated." In other words, the same proof text that later on will be used for what? To prove the importance of burial in the land of Israel, when you go to Tannaitic sources, it's used for dwelling in the land of Israel. And so this is again what I'm suggesting, that this goes through some sort of change here, and the attitude towards those people living abroad, and we will skip over all of 13, because I want to get to the next source. Which is also 13, this is some miracle here, right? But the source here is much more, you know, it's not halachic, and it's a source of two rabbis talking. And the Babylonians knew exactly what their compatriots in Eretz Israel thought about them. Resh Lakish, third century rabbi in Israel, was swimming in the Jordan one day, that's a typo, when Rabbi Bar Chana, Babylonian rabbi, appeared and offered him his hand. Now this is, man, this is like a metaphor almost. In other words, you can imagine a person swimming. There are all sorts of stories, by the way, of Resh Lakish and water and Rabbi Yochanan, some of which I can't even tell in a mixed audience. Right? But this story, he's offering him a hand. And what do you sense? Meaning what? We'd like to help you, right? This sense of right? He, Resh Lakish, proclaimed, "By God, how I hate you people. You Babylonians? For it is written," right, Shir HaShirim, "if she shall be a wall, we will build upon her a turret of silver," right? "If she be a door, we will enclose her with borders of cedar. Had you made yourselves like a wall and all come up in the days of Ezra," in other words, when you could have come back from Babylonia, now he says, as a wall, why? You should have come back en masse. Because that statement that I quoted from Rav Yehuda in Pompidita, okay, is what later on is followed by a statement that God made the people of Israel take an oath, "Shelo ya'alu kechoma," or "bechoma." So you see the wall here. In other words, the Babylonians say you shouldn't go back en masse. Had you then, in the days of Ezra, come back, all right, Had you made yourselves like a wall and all come back in the days of Ezra, you would have been compared to silver which cannot rot. Now that you've come up like doors, you are like cedar wood, with where rottenness prevails. In other words, here you have the Israeli basically saying, you rabbis living, or Jews, or rabbis living in Babylonia, are the rot of our people living where you live. We can't avoid this. There's tension here in the air, right? Sometimes the stories are kind of, somewhat humorous almost. And this is a late story, but I couldn't exclude it. It once happened that a disciple of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, again Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, went abroad and he returned wealthy. He was probably 14. A disciple, this is so typical, we all recognize this. One of our friends goes to Chutz La'aretz, and then he invites us back to the King David for supper, right? And we're supposed to be very envious, and maybe some of us are. And so he returned wealthy, and all the disciples saw him and wished to also go abroad. This is, right? I could name names, but I'm sure you all have friends, right? Rabbi Shimon was aware that his disciples want to go abroad and get rich. Was aware and removed them to the valley near his town of Miron. There he prayed before God, Bika, bika, himali dinarei zahav, O valley, fill up with golden dinars. And it filled up with golden dinars. In other words, there's wealth in this land also. Even golden dinars, miraculous golden dinars. And then we all imagine they're all about to pounce on these golden dinars. And at the last moment, he remembers to tell them. He told them, whoever wishes to take, let him come and take. Bevakasha. But know you that whoever takes now makes a withdrawal against his reward in the next world. In other words, this is right. And we all imagine, no, we won't take them, right? But again, this idea that there's wealth there abroad. The last text that I wanted to bring gives us an interesting insight into one element. Rabbis from the land of Israel don't always just leave the land to move abroad. They visit the diaspora as well. My late teacher, Professor Safrai, wrote an article on travels of the rabbis to Rome. But it wasn't only Rome. Some of the stories are really pretty. They're just very, I don't know, touching. Source number 15 I always found touching. A story. The word is delama. Delama is drama. Drama, a story. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua and Rabban Gamliel, so this is the first generation after the destruction, went to Rome. Doesn't tell us why they went, and we don't know. But they entered a place, and this is really touching, and found children making small piles. They were making, you could almost imagine, there's a word in Jerusalem, young Yerushalmim know the word kubabot, right? It's like mud piles or sand piles. They're making little mounds. And what are they saying, the young children? This is what the residents of Eretz Israel do. They say, this mound will be Truma. This is Maaser. They're playing Trumot and Maasrot, which I'm sure made their school teacher very happy, right? But again, this image of these Jews living in the diaspora, imagining what it might be like to live in the land of Israel. And so the rabbi said, it appears there are Jews here. Well, yes, you don't need, right. However, we have stories where one of the rabbis, Joshua ben Hanania, goes to Alexandria, and the Alexandrian Jews ask him a whole series of questions in 16. I have to skip over that. Number 17 is interesting. The famous Rabbi Akiva. We find Rabbi Akiva throughout the diaspora. So much so that what the great Jewish historian of the 19th century, Heinrich Kretz, in his history, claimed, why is Rabbi Akiva all over the place? He's helping to plot the Bar Kokhba war. We all know that there's a famous statement where Rabbi Akiva says, Dein Malka Meshicha, this is the king, the Messiah. So Rabbi Akiva is always, the image of him is a big supporter of the Bar Kokhba war. And so Gretz says, this is why he's traveling all over the place. He's trying to get diaspora support. If Gretz is right, all I can say is, Rabbi Akiva was a great Torah scholar. We know nothing about anybody coming from the diaspora to support Bar Kokhba and the uprising. So, you know, we can't win them all, as it were. But Akiva goes not just in the Naharda, he proclaims leap year. He proclaims a leap year. And next week, we're going to see that this was the basis for another Babylonian claiming, I can do this too. If Rabbi Akiva can do this, I can do this. And we'll read the story next week. But look at source number 18. Here, he's really traveling around. What proof is there that the word Yovel means a ram? It has been taught. By the way, we read the word Yovel in this week's part. We're going to read it in this week. Bimshocha Yovel. Hema Ya'alu. Ram's horn, right? It has been taught. Rabbi Akiva said, when I went to Arabia, they used to call a ram Yobla. Rabbi Akiva further said, when I went to Galia, they used to call a Nida Galmuda. When I went to Africa, they used, and he's, in other words, he's using his travels to explain all sorts of words in Hebrew. Source number 19, which is our last source, Rabbi Akiva said, when I once set sail at sea, I saw a ship sink and was distressed because of a disciple of the sages. By the way, disciple of the sages, what is the word here in Hebrew? If you remember one thing, the word tafchet, right, should be read not Talmid Chacham, but Talmid Chachamim. There is no such thing as Talmid Chacham, right? There is, right? There is Talmid Chachamim and Talmidei Chachamim, right? But, and then from the plural, people extracted the singular, Talmid Chacham. But that's a mistake. How do I know this? Because of manuscripts. When you have Tafchet written out in full in manuscripts, it's Talmid Chachamim in the good manuscript. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva said, I once went set sail, I saw a ship sink, and a disciple of the sages was aboard. And when I arrived at the land of Cappadocia, which takes us to Turkey already, I saw him, meaning that disciple, sitting before me and asking questions of halacha. In other words, what does Rabbi Akiva claim? That when he goes aboard, what is one of the things he's doing? He's teaching, and that there's a group there that's able to sit, some sort of Beit Midrash. And I said, my son, how did you come from sea? And he says, well, a wave carried me, and so on. I want to sum up what we've seen, and if there are some questions, we have enough time. What I tried to show is the issue of Jews living abroad doesn't pass quietly in our sources. And this is diametrically opposed to the Second Temple period. In the Second Temple period, it's not an issue. When the Hasmoneans are successful in Jerusalem, so yes, we have the second book of Maccabees, where letters appear at the beginning of the book, where the Jerusalemites write abroad saying, we want you to know, we've had a wonderful victory here, we want you to celebrate with us. In other words, there's no animosity there, there's no tension whatsoever in the books of Maccabees between center and diaspora. What is amazing is that there is no tension even in the immediate post-temple period, meaning the first two generations. And again, as I say, we have hundreds of statements from the rabbis of the first two generations. None of them talk about the requirement of living in the land and not leaving the land and so on. Not only that, when you get to the Talmud period, you find for the first time rabbis kissing the land as they arrive. Rabbis talking about the supernatural qualities of the land of Israel. Its fruit grows bigger and faster than fruit anywhere else in the world, etc., etc. This is something, that certainly people like Philo and Josephus would never say that, but even the early rabbis don't say that. And you get a sense that somebody is building up the farther removed we get from a state in Judea, the more the focal point sets now on Judea. And now the question is, who's doing the talking? If it's the Israeli rabbis, it's a much more practical, it's forbidden to leave the land. If you live there, you don't have a God. If you talk to the Babylonian rabbis, they will tell you, and we'll see this next week, yes, ultimately there will be a restoration to the land of Israel in some sort of messianic age. In fact, very, very similar to ideology that we'll hear in the 20th century from people like the Satmar Rebbe or something like that, who doesn't deny a messianic era but says that it'll come of its own. There's no way you can push it forward. There's no way that you can bring it about by doing something except waiting for that day to come. And you get a sense that we are now on the very edge of a split between the two. Now, of course, I go back to the beginning of my talk today. Does that mean that we're again at this dispute between Judaism as a nationality, Judaism as a religion? Can I say that the Israeli rabbis seem to still think in terms of ethnos and nationhood, and a nation needs a country and a nation needs a capital city? And the rabbis abroad maybe have already accepted some of that spiritualizing factor they had, that Judaism has evolved into what? Into the world of Torah. Because that's exactly what the Babylonian rabbis will tell us. That the central issue for us is Torah. And wherever the greatest Torah scholar is, that's where the center of Judaism is at any given time. And as we'll see, words like Zion, Zion, or even Yerushalayim take on a totally different meaning. And we can talk about Yerushalayim Asher B'Sefarad, right, according to one of the prophets. Or when we come to the late Middle Ages, Yerushalayim is mobile. So if you come to Lithuania, you come to, right, to Vilnius, which is what? Yerushalayim Delita. So Yerushalayim is no longer a piece of territory. It's no longer real estate. What is it? It's a concept. It's a concept of where Torah resides at any given time. This is where the issue of diaspora becomes very, very critical. In our talk next week, we're going to see precisely how the rabbis of Babylonia address this issue. The question is, Yehuda HaNasi, on the one hand, is the Palestinian patriarch. He's the focal point of a Jewish nationality, right? On the other hand, by editing the Mishnah, by codifying the Mishnah, he's enabling other groups outside of the land to now go off on their own. That process is going to be repeated time and time again, right? Where you are so successful that ultimately that's your undoing. The same thing would happen in Babylonia generations later, where the Geonim, the heads of the yeshivot in Babylonia, were so successful in spreading their Torah around North Africa and Spain that nobody needs them anymore. And we actually have a very famous story in a book called Sefer HaKabbalah of Avraham ben Daud, where he says that some Jews were captured at sea, and they were spread, some Jewish rabbis, and they were spread to different countries, and they spread Torah all over the place. In other words, success can be your undoing. So, yes, you're right about that. But, of course, Martin Goodman takes that a bit further. Martin Goodman says, it's not by chance that when the Romans finally agreed to recognize a Jewish leader, the leader was someone like Yehuda HaNasi, meaning, or the patriarch, meaning what? A religious leader. In other words, they're not, although we know that the Nasi claims to be of Davidic descent as well, so there's some sort of a monarchical element. But your question is correct, and that's exactly what's going to happen. The Babylonians are going to say, we'll see this next week, Asinu Atzmenu in Bavel, Ke'eretz Yisrael, from the day that Rav Huna came, or from the day that Rav came back to Babylonia. Rav is a Babylonian rabbi who studied a few years in Israel, came back to Bavel, and they will say, we are now the equivalent. And in no uncertain terms, we can learn Mishnah just as well as you can. And you should know that, you know, I have to end off on this, but. And I'm going to quote somebody else for the first time today. As a result, Yehuda HaNasi becomes a very problematical person in the 19th century when you read the Maskilim, a Jewish Maskilim of the 19th century. On the one hand, they loved him. Why? He's for learning Greek. His best friend is Antoninus, the Roman emperor, right? He's a man of the world. He's a universal, right? And so on. And so at first, the early Maskilim really loved him. But then they suddenly realized, but he edited the Mishnah. He fossilized halacha. He created something that can't be changed. He's the ultimate, right? This is the ruin, right? Because the Maskilim were also reformers as well. Not all of them, but many of them, right? And so suddenly he becomes the enemy. And you can see the switch. And for this, you'll have to read my son's book, Pshuta Shel Mishnah. Right, I have, one of my children wrote a book exactly on this topic. I just couldn't, right, not mention this. So we'll end on this.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.